Curtis Sittenfeld is the best-selling author of the novels Romantic Comedy, Prep, The Man of My Dreams, American Wife, and Rodham. In her second story collection, Show Don't Tell, she conjures up characters that are real, so real that they seem like old friends, laying bare the moments when their long-held beliefs are overturned. Sittenfeld has established a reputation as a sharp chronicler of the modern age who humanizes her subjects even as she skewers them. Throughout the dozen stories in Show Don't Tell, Sittenfeld upends assumptions about marriage, friendship, fame, and artistic ambition. Again, the name of the book is Show Don't Tell, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Curtis Sittenfeld back. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you on the program.
What a delight to be on the program.
Thank you so much. I love talking to you about your work. I love reading your work. This is a tremendous collection of stories. Many have appeared elsewhere, and I'm just interested in how a collection comes about to the point of where you say, oh, this now is the time to start thinking in terms of a collection.
So I think for me, it was that there was kind of enough stories. I mean, I'm not sure what the minimum number of stories is for anyone's collection. I don't, maybe like 5 or 6 or 7, but I came to a point, I had had 9 stories published since my last story collection. And then I knew that my publisher would want me to sort of include some number of unpublished stories. Just so, I mean, the truth is, even if you are a person who like tried to get your hands on everything I wrote, which would be very flattering if you were that kind of person, a lot of these are in like, you know, they're behind paywalls or they were not necessarily published to much fanfare. So of course, so even if you have read some of the stories, I would think you've probably read a maximum of half of them. But I basically just kind of felt like, you know, the stories are like, especially they're kind of part of a cultural moment, and I thought maybe they could be published adjacent to the cultural moment that they cover and not too far into the future.
So talk a little bit about that, of what you feel this cultural moment is.
Well, so a lot of the stories, there's a couple ways of answering that. A lot of the stories feature women in their, you know, 40s or early 50s, and then even within that category, like a lot of them looking back at something that happened when they were teenagers or in their 20s or something. So it's sort of, you know, I say this in a happy way, it's like a middle-aged collection, I think, but then it also probably focuses on, you know, maybe the years since like 2016-ish, the last 10 years, I think. And that can mean politically, socially, you know, pandemic-ishly, post-pandemic-ishly. It's interesting now that 5 years have passed since the beginning of the shutdown for most Americans, you know, which was like mid-March 2020. And I do think that there are ways, even now, that I keep discovering, like sort of being affected by the pandemic. You know, like there was the sort of immediate stuff and maybe some of the medium stuff and some of the longer, you know, like, you know, friendships might have become closer or less close, you know, marriages might have ended, children, you know, who maybe seemed like they were kind of fine, there might be like lingering effects, and people think, well, is it because of the pandemic or is it just because of life? And I don't know, just I think we all carry around the knowledge like it happened, it could happen again, it could be worse. This is not a very uplifting conversation, but
but it is in the sense of in this moment these characters are going through a very similar moment, and we can relate to that because at the end of the day, no matter what else is happening in the greater world, we still have the minutiae of our daily lives.
I absolutely think that's true. And I think that that can even contribute to like a little bit of a feeling of like whiplash as we all go through our days, where it's kind of like this catastrophic thing is happening. And then you're like, I kind of want a snack, like, you know, and holding these sort of disjointed thoughts and these different emotions, can be very confusing.
We are talking to Curtis Sittenfeld. The name of the new collection is Show, Don't Tell. It is published by Random House. I was struck by your interest in where people end up at a certain point in their life, and in the sense of that connection to high school, that connection to college, of who you stay friends with, of who you don't stay friends with. There's many aspects of that within this collection.
I would agree with that. That there is, I mean, something that is really interesting to me is for all of us, we can have an experience and it could be positive, it could be negative, and then 20 years or 30 years can pass. And to some extent, the experience is like frozen or preserved in amber, but our understanding of it can shift very dramatically because we have changed as we've gotten older. So it's like, we can feel like somebody wronged us, and then like a couple decades pass, and we think, oh no, I was the person who wronged them. Or it can kind of be like, we can feel like we were so embarrassed by something we did at the time, and then we can think like, oh my God, actually, I had nothing to be embarrassed about, and like what that other person did was super inappropriate. So, or it can kind of be like, oh, that was a really touching, sweet moment that I didn't recognize as touching and sweet. So I just think that that's like endlessly fascinating. Like the passage of time is endlessly fascinating.
And what you do, and I think brilliantly, is you will go back to a moment in a character's life that carried through, that made an impression. And sometimes I know as a human, I wish I had more, sometimes more clarity in those moments that I could remember them better. But when a character does that, of how amazing that is to be able to put those strands together.
I mean, I do think that you sort of don't even necessarily know in the moments. You don't know to file it away in your memory.
Right.
That like this will loom large. This will stay with me.
And that has a lot to do with what you write about, right? I mean, that has a lot to do with the, for want of a better word, the themes that you write about, not only in this collection, but just in general, when you're writing, as I mentioned in the introduction, of marriage or fame or ambition or arts. Those are all things that we can relate to.
Yeah, I mean, probably some people can relate more easily than others, but yes. But I mean, I recently spoke at a college. I did think like, oh my goodness, the my and my and the students, a bunch of the students had read my first story collection, and I did think the characters must seem so old to them. I mean, not in a bad way, but just they must seem so old.
But it doesn't matter, does it?
I mean, it depends. I think that like some people like re books that kind of reflect their own experiences or like experiences that could plausibly be theirs. Some people, like books that kind of introduce them to experiences that they would never have in their own life. And I mean, neither is really right or wrong. I would say I like both.
And when you are writing a story in let's use the stories in this collection, the 12 stories in this collection, that they do, unlike many stories, have a very they have a beginning, a middle, and an end. There is a very strong form to them.
Thank you. I mean, I do think that that's the kind of story that I like, but I think what you're saying is actually kind of subjective because, sometimes people will feel like a story about like say like, there's a woman who on a Friday gets notified that she needs to have a follow-up to her mammogram, which obviously means something could be seriously wrong, and it kind of follows her over the course of the weekend. As she interacts with her husband and her teenage son, and does not tell either of them about this, sort of confusing test result. And then she goes to the follow-up appointment on Monday morning. And it's like some people might think, oh my gosh, that's so suspenseful. And other people might think, like, there's no external plot. I mean, it's kind of, I feel like for me, I sort of think of things in terms of like, how much do the events of the story matter to the characters, not how objectively important they are.
I understand, yes. But I guess also is that there are many novels, there are many stories where you are racing to a point where there is the ending to find out whether you're going to get dot dot dot, and then the door opens and then the book ends. And you're like, all right, well, did they get it or
Oh,
not?
interesting. And you mean like I give the information of
You
like,
give that information.
oh yeah. I mean, I wanna toy with the reader only in ways that the reader will find satisfying, not that the reader will find unsatisfying. I mean, I really do think probably above all, my job as a writer is to kind of entertain and engage the reader. And then there's a lot of other stuff I can do, but that's like my primary responsibility.
So tell us about the title story that where we meet Ruthie Flaherty.
So it's 19, I think it's 19, is it 97 or
I
something?
believe so,
Six. Like
96, 97.
it's the late 90s. And Ruthie is a grad student in a program that closely resembles the Iowa Writers' Workshop, but is not identified as such. And it's like the week that the first year students are going to find out what their funding is for their second year. And people are sort of like super, worked up, agitated, competitive. And it comes down to something like the maximum you can get for a fellowship is like $6,600 for the year. And then, like, the least you can get is like $6,200. So it's these sort of tiny differences that loom very large. And Ruthie is like has no more perspective or distance on all this stuff than anyone else does. And then it jumps far into the future after this night and kind of talks about, what became of a few people in the story and their writing aspirations.
We are talking to Curtis Sittenfeld. The new collection of stories is Show, Don't Tell. It is published by Random House. You have a story in here, A for Alone, which is you have a character that is looking to disprove the so-called Mike Pence rule. My God, I love this story.
Ha.
Give me a sense of how it manifested itself.
Well, so, I mean, as some of your listeners probably know, the Mike Pence rule, which is also known as the Billy Graham rule, is this idea that men and women should not spend time one-on-one unless they're married to each other. And Mike Pence apparently followed this rule. So, like, if he had, I suppose, like if there was someone on his wife or his staff, a woman, I think I guess he would not meet with her one on one. There would have to be another person present. And this information emerged, I'm trying to think if it was maybe 2019 or 2020. It was in an article in the Washington Post, and it wasn't the focus of the article. It was just sort of there was like a mention of it, but it did kind of enter the cultural conversation for a few days. And I thought at the time, I thought, oh, that's really sexist. It sort of blocks women's professional advancement. It's like very heteronormative to kind of feel like, well, a man and a woman shouldn't be alone together, but anyone else can, like two men can be because they would never be attracted to each other or whatever. And then I thought, at the time, I lived in suburban St. Louis, Missouri. And I thought, well, how often do I spend time one-on-one with a man? Or like if I reached out to like a man on my street and I was married and he was married and said like, would you like to get dinner, like I feel like there would be reverberations. So it was kind of, I was thinking about like, this rule can seem so preposterous from some angles, and then from other angles there's like a pretty high proportion of like married adults in the US who follow it no matter what their political persuasion is. And so I would say the story was born out of that.
Because both with Mike Pence and with the Billy Graham connotation, does come down to be a religious question, ultimately, in those terms.
Yeah. Political and religious. Yeah, I think that's accurate.
So in the book and in the story, it ends up being basically a questionnaire. Are you aware of this? What's your opinion of this rule? And when I invited you to lunch, what was your reaction?
So the protagonist is a woman named Irene, who is an artist. She's like a sort of visual artist. And she decides to very deliberately flout this rule and essentially invite every man she knows to have lunch with her one-on-one, sequentially, not simultaneously. And then, as you're saying, she gives them a questionnaire. But then there end up being sort of unanticipated developments in the story. I'm sure nobody can guess what they would be.
Well, and you say in the story, in October, the Me Too movement attracts widespread attention, which means that Irene's project has become more relevant or more unsavory or both. And that I love that line because that's exactly it.
If you are a sort of creative person, you know, most of us are sort of part of the culture, like we're humans too. And you can write something where the meaning changes just the way, you know, like you can look back on something that happened 20 years ago and you have a really different interpretation. Like external events can almost change the meaning of a piece of art that someone has created.
You have a story in the collection, Lost But Not Forgotten, and this is a callback, a throwback to your character in your novel, Prep, Lee. And I'm curious, was it always an intention, or at what point did you think it would be fun to revisit that particular character?
So my novel, Prep, my first novel, came out 20 years ago in January 2005. And I think it occurred to me very early on, like, you know, do I have a sequel? Like, should I portray Lee, the protagonist, as a grown-up? And there were sort of pros and cons to doing it. And writing a sequel short story rather than a sequel novel felt like splitting the difference. Like, it's sort of dipping back into that world, but they're lower stakes than with a novel.
In lower stakes in the sense of, but it still allows you to explore a character and to give us, the reader, an idea of what that character is up to now, and also would stand a standalone as well, right? I mean, if you had not read Prep, you'd be fine.
I think that's accurate. Because, I mean, then there's also the category of person who, like, did read Prep, but read it, like, 19 years ago or 12 years ago. So
right.
Like remembers it, you know, not so. So I mean, in the reunion, like Prep is about Lee when she's a student at this elite Massachusetts boarding school. And the story, Lost But Not Forgotten, follows Lee back to her 30th reunion. So, she's like close to 50 years old, which, you know, many, many people have attended school reunions. So there's, if not a universal aspect, there's sort of a widespread aspect that people can probably relate to.
When you are writing stories, I'm always fascinated by this, and will often ask writers who write both stories and novels, and it's all over the place in responses, but I'm interested in where you come down on it. Are you comfortable being involved in a novel and writing a story, or do they have to be separate enterprises?
I think I switch back and forth a little bit more. I mean, sometimes I'm writing a novel and I honestly get a little sick of it. And so maybe, but actually what I might do is I have an idea for a story and it feels really like enticing and I start writing it and I kind of cure myself of wanting to write it by starting and by it being like, I think of course hope springs eternal, so I think it's going to be magical, and then it's like not magical, it's sort of rough drafty like everything else, and then I'm able to go back to the novel and focus.
I was reading a review of this book, and I don't remember, I just wrote it down in my notes and I don't recall what review it was, but it said that you are irresistibly drawn to the awkward. Do you find that to be accurate?
I mean, I think I don't shy from the awkward. Like, I try to write a version of reality. Of course, it's not everyone's version of reality, but I try to make my characters and their situations kind of plausibly realistic. And so I think that kind of means that, like, every emotion or every mood comes through. Like, all of us going through a day, like, there probably is an awkward moment, or there is, like, a funny moment, or there is a touching moment. And so I just kind of try to include all of that.
Well, the term with that awkwardness comes, I think, an understanding and a reality that not everything is always 100% pleasant.
Is that what you learned from reading my story clip?
No, not at all. But what I did learn is that I do think that there is a looking back to things. And I said this earlier, you look back to things and you think, oh, all right, so this tracks. Because sometimes you wake up and you think, well, how did I get here? This is not what I signed up for. And then as you start to do a little research, you realize, oh, well, this same thing happened to me 22 years ago, so this shouldn't be all that big of a shock.
Yeah, I mean, that we're always still ourselves in some essential way.
When you come to the point where the stories start to collect and do you worry about placement? Do you worry about theme? Do you worry about how they will work up against another, or just assume that people are going to read them one by one or out of context anyway?
So, I mean, I think carefully about the order of the stories, and if they seem super similar, I probably would try to space them out and not put them back to back. That said, I also think I kind of embrace the fact that a lot of these stories are thematically similar. Like, a lot of them are about progressive, educated, middle-aged women in the Midwest who like believe one thing and find their beliefs challenged, whether it's about themselves or, you know, the community they live in or their marriage or whatever. I kind of like when a collection reveals a writer's obsessions. And I think that my obsessions are, like, sort of apparent in this collection. But I also do see the stories as distinct from each other, and they all have their own plot.
And when it comes to the obsessions, it does have to do with some sense of, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but some sense of nostalgia, some sense of looking forward, looking backward, and sort of trying to figure out if this current lot in life is good enough.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. I think that's, like, a pretty accurate description. I mean, I probably think more in terms of, like, a few different recurring themes instead of almost, like, what one question are these stories trying to answer? But I don't disagree with anything you're saying.
No. And certainly there are many questions that are answered here and many things that you explore. It is curious to me, though, that as you're reading these, for me as a reader, of just how, and I hope you'll take this as a compliment, which is how I intend it, but they're so comfortable. There's I mean, I mentioned, I wanted to say this because I mentioned about awkward, but there's awkward moments, but they're also such real uncomfortable moments that it just seems like, oh, all right, this is kind of like, this could have been my Thursday.
Ha. I mean, thank you. I think that I certainly make an effort to make my language clear and sort of smooth and accessible. Like, it's, I think that the situations are kind of complex, but the language is supposed to be just sort of a pleasure to read, or smooth enough that you don't even notice, almost. You don't even feel like you're reading. You just feel like you're experiencing what the characters are experiencing.
And that's a great point, because many of the situations are incredibly complex, aren't they?
Yeah. And sort of, it's not necessarily entirely clear in some cases who's in the wrong and who's in the right.
You don't want to necessarily answer that for us.
I would say that's correct too. Like, I think it's just so much more interesting. Like, if we know a person in real life and we have mixed feelings about the person and we can recognize that they have like good and bad or attractive and unattractive qualities, it's almost like we're forced to think about that person and to kind of, I don't know, almost like take them seriously. Whereas if someone is just like so charming that everyone likes them, it's like, of course we like them. Or if they're so awful that it's like everyone hates them, then we can just kind of put them in a category and not think about it. But I think it's interesting to have to grapple with contradictions and complexity.
The name of the new book is Show, Don't Tell. It is now out from Random House. Curtis Sittenfeld, it's always a great pleasure to speak with you. I thank you so much for sharing with us. Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Be well. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.